Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. It's the news roundup where we check in with area journalists, talk about some of the stories making regional headlines this week. Some Cape Cod lawmakers are pushing for the state to extend daily commuter rail to the Cape. And in a separate story, the Bourne and Sagamore bridges are up for adoption. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, officials met in Buzzards Bay this week to talk about bringing commuter rail to the region. Tell us about that.
Yeah, some state legislators and others who are advocating for the Cape to get daily train service held a press conference this week in Buzzards Bay Park, which is by the canal and the railroad bridge there. State Senator Dylan Fernandez was there, Representative Kip Diggs, Representative Steve Ixaros, two members of the Bourne Select Board, plus some support also from the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority had officials there as well. What they're saying now is that South Coast Rail is done. Ridership is considered to be good there. And it's kind of Cape Cod's turn, they're saying, to get the return of daily commuter rail. They say the population has grown here significantly over the years since rail went away in the middle of the last century. We do know, you know, from studies from the Cape Cod Commission that many more people are crossing those bridges to come onto the Cape for work. Senator Fernandez said ridership on South Coast Rail is strong and it could be viable here as well, at least to Buzzards Bay first. They're talking about, which I think is to keep the cost down. They're talking about what it would cost just to go to Buzzards Bay. But of course, that is not actually over the canal. They're saying it could start with a connection between Buzzards Bay and Middleborough, so people could go from there and connect to South Coast Rail, connect to Boston, and so on.
And you touched on ended in like 1950 something, right? We did have year-round train service from Boston at one time.
Yes. So much like the South Coast, this area has had various forms of train service over the centuries, and there was daily train service between Boston and Cape Cod into the middle of the last century. Senator Fernandez says it ended in 1959.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay. State legislators were advocating for Cape Rail, but they're not saying the state has committed to pursue it right away.
That's right. I mean, to my knowledge, it's not funded either. It would take years to get a project like that funded. Fernandez pointed to a state study from 2021. It was done with assistance from the Cape Cod Commission. That study pegged the cost of going only to Buzzards Bay at $67 million. That's with no adjusting for inflation over time. And it's also much lower than the South Coast Rail cost, which was roughly $1 billion, actually, I think slightly over $1 billion. It would do a lot less, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, South Coast Rail was a huge project. But that 2021 study claiming this only $67 million to go to Buzzards Bay made some pretty big assumptions. It assumed that rail to Buzzards Bay would only use existing train cars they already own and only use existing infrastructure that's already being used. So it's unclear, really, whether it would be feasible for Cape Rail to use all of those things. Another question is, what would the public think about doing that and just ending the line in Buzzards Bay, even temporarily, because people would still have to drive over the bridge? So the train ride from Boston to Buzzards Bay has been estimated at about 93 minutes. I don't know if everyone would do it, but certainly for some people who sit in a lot of traffic, it would be quicker. Representative Diggs said it would be much faster than the almost 2 hours it takes him when the traffic is significant going to Boston.
Yeah. Now, how does the town of Bourne feel about the train?
Well, there were two select board members at this press conference this week supporting it, Peter Meyer and Anne-Marie Cerunian. The town of Bourne has been classified as an MBTA community under the law because it borders Plymouth. And that law requires towns in or adjacent to train service to create a multifamily housing district by right. Select board member Anne-Marie Cerunian said Bourne really has embraced the whole thing, though. Some communities have not, but she said Bourne has. Their town meeting approved an overlay district in Buzzards Bay last fall for that housing. And she said time and time again, Bourne has said yes to rail. Of course, that does not mean that every single person as enthusiastic about train service coming to the community. I did talk with a Buzzards Bay resident this week who was there at the park walking her dog right before the legislators started talking. Her name is Sue Barlow. And she said she worries that having the train come to Buzzards Bay would bring more traffic in the sense of more people wanting to move to the Cape because then they could commute north. And she feels, you know, it could change the village a little bit.
All right. I want to get to the story about adopting a bridge. But first, I know you worked this week to get an update on the state appeal regarding disposal of water at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth. So what's happening with that?
Yeah. So we have been kind of touching on this every week as there are little developments. So after we reported last week that this appeal still had not been finalized by the Department of Environmental Protection, I just wanted to try to push the department to provide an estimated timeline for that. Quick recap here. The owner of the Pilgrim Nuclear Plant is appealing a state decision that said they could not discharge industrial water into Cape Cod Bay. An appeals officer makes a recommendation. That happened 6 months ago. But the commissioner of the department, her name is Bonnie Heipel, she still has to review it and finalize it for it to be real, essentially. And so wanted to find out the timing on that. Why, you know, why is it taking 6 months? A spokesperson for the Department of Environmental Protection, Lauren Mureschi, really would not give a timeline. She said Heipel is working on it. It is true that the appeal document is almost 60 pages long, and it's not like this is the only appeal happening in the department, you know, at a time. But Mureschi would not give any kind of timeline for when the appeal could be finalized.
All right. Let's talk about the bridges. As we know, the Bourne and Sagamore bridges are being replaced. And now the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says the old bridges are being offered for adoption.
Yeah. So we had a little bit of fun with this. Their announcement was titled Historic Bridges Available for Adoption, which kind of sounds to me either like pet adoption or maybe like adopt a highway for you know, litter cleanup or something like that. But it's neither of those things. It is kind of a real serious thing because federal law requires a transportation asset like the bridges to be offered for reuse or for alternative use when it's going to be removed like this. I did talk to a spokesperson for the Army Corps of Engineers, Troy Darr, and he told me about that. So it has to be done. And they are looking for proposals. It will be interesting to see what people propose. I asked him if there was any kind of precedent for this. He says he's kind of new to the topic, but the most famous example, he says, is London Bridge.
As in London, England.
Yes, London, England. There have been several London bridges over the centuries, but the one built in 1831 was replaced there in the late 1960s. So some of that was moved. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But I just want to be clear that that tall, famous bridge in London that everyone sees in the photos is called Tower Bridge. So this is not that. There is another London bridge that's not quite as photogenic as that. but when it was replaced in the 60s, the stone facing from that bridge was moved to the U.S. state of Arizona. And it became, again, sort of the cosmetic outer surface of a new bridge being built there in Arizona. The Cape Cod bridges are steel truss, you know, bridges. They're not the same. They don't have that kind of stone facing. When I think about this, of course, I think of the value of all that steel. But the Army Corps did warn that those bridges are covered in lead paint. So that would be a job to deal with that. The bridges are also obviously extremely big and heavy. Mm-hmm. The Bourne Bridge is the larger one of the two. The steel alone in the Bourne Bridge weighs more than 7,200 tons.
Wow. It will be interesting to see what proposals we get.
Yes.
For sure. All right. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette.
Thanks.
All right. We know that the salt marshes are important native habitat that protect us from flooding and shoreline erosion. They're also blue carbon habitats that are an important defense against climate change. CIA Science and Environment reporter Amy Culp-Noyes is here to talk about that. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
So salt marshes play an important role in the carbon cycle. And for those of us who've been out of school for a while, remind us.
Sure. The carbon cycle is a closed system like the water cycle. There's a finite amount of carbon that moves through the system between the atmosphere, oceans, rocks, soil, living organisms. In places like salt marshes, seagrass beds, mangroves, oceans, and forests are carbon sinks. So they pull more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere than they release into it. And carbon captured by the ocean and coastal habitats are called blue carbon. And blue carbon habitats are believed to sequester 10 times more carbon than tropical forests.
That's a lot. Yeah. All right. And you met up with a team from HUI taking salt marsh measurements at Cockle Cove in Chatham. What are they studying?
So much of what we know about salt marshes is based on research done in the summer when the weather's nice and, frankly, researchers want to be out there. Coastal hydrologist Julia Guimond and postdoc Elisa Bowles are working on a National Science Foundation project that's examining how salt marshes function in the winter and if there's a seasonal effect on carbon sequestration. We know salt marshes are in much different places when it's cold outside, right? They're not the same. The wind's whipping around, the vegetation's dead, the water's really cold. But we don't know much about how those factors affect how the marshes function.
Some people may think, like, why does temperature matter? We know it matters for the chemistry, right? Temperature influences reaction rates, but also matters for not just the flow paths, like if it's frozen, then water can't flow, but also the speed at which the water's moving through the system, which has been a fun find.
So cold water is more viscous than warmer water, and due to that, it moves more slowly. So they're trying to determine how that affects the way carbon moves through the marsh systems. And I'll add that Chatham is the southernmost site in this study. They're also recording data from three salt marshes in Maine. And that's allowed them to compare how marshes perform several functions varying in varying winter weather conditions, not just carbon sequestration. Here's Guimond again.
These marshes sort of protect the upland areas from flooding. You can imagine as if a surge comes in like this winter nor'easter, the vegetation in the marsh platform actually slows that surge. But what happens in the winter when there's snow, when there's ice, we don't have a good understanding. So at some of the other sites, we have cameras on the marsh so we can see that ice accumulation, the snow deposition, and then how that affects flooding over the marsh platform, sort of informing how that ecosystem service holds up in the winter.
So right now they're 2 years into a 3-year project, so we should see them back out there next winter as well.
All right, CAI Science and Environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes, thank you.
Thank you.
Martha's Vineyard voters head to the polls this Tuesday for what has been widely reported as the most expensive infrastructure project ever on the island, the renovation and addition to the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School. CAI Sam Houghton joins us. Sam, this is over $330 million, right? So why so expensive?
Yeah. excuse me. Well, actually, it's actually in line with other high school building projects around the state. I think a recent record was the Lexington High School, which was estimated now at something like $660 million, a lot of money. And if you think about the Vineyard High School, it's on an island, so there are all kinds of added expenses, not just shipping supplies, but shipping workers to the island as well. So it could have been more expensive. But right, this is a renovation and an addition. The big chunk of the renovation includes upgrading mechanics, fixing some long-time issues. The school was originally built over 60 years ago, and that comes with a lot of issues. There are concerns from staff about air quality because of mold throughout the school. I guess the roof is leaking in areas. There have been broken pipes. The superintendent told me that there were several broken pipes over the winter, and that's led to flooding. There's also asbestos in some areas that will have to be removed. And the boilers, some reporting has shown those are original to the 60-year-old building. And a lot of these issues have been fixed kind of with temporary solutions over the years. I think even duct tape has been used, buckets. And then if you kind of, fixing these lingering issues is going to be a big thing. But then the addition, a big piece of that is better space to the school's vocational offerings or the trades. And the superintendent saying this was a really big sticking point from the state when offering financial help. They wanted to see upgrades to the vocational offerings. And he said himself that, you know, on the island, there's a real need for workers in the trades. And this will kind of help create a better pipeline from the high school to the field.
And what should voters know going into this?
Yeah, a couple of neat things here, depending on how you look at it. But we've been told, you know, it's the most expensive regional project undertaken by the island at $330 million. Also, apparently the first time that all six towns have voted on the same day on a single issue, which I think some of our listeners may be surprised. There are six very individual towns on the island. But the vote, right, it's going to be on Tuesday. Polls open from 11 to 7 in each town. And I think the big thing to consider here, there's some bad history on the island funding schools. Several years ago, Tisbury voters rejected a project to replace the Tisbury School. That vote failed by the slimmest of margins. People probably remember that. And the town lost out on a lot of state funding, reimbursement funding. Then a few months later, the town was forced to do the project anyways because of air quality issues. So they lost out on state funding, had to do the project anyways at a much higher cost to taxpayers. And in Tisbury, they're really still lamenting that decision years down the line. And school officials are saying, look, if we reject this high school plan, we're going to have to do a lot of the work anyways. About $200 million worth is what the superintendent told me. And you likely won't get state funding if you reject this vote. And the state for this project has pledged about $70 million, $75 million. Mm. So that's the school administration's argument headed into this. But at the same time, you know, costs are going up everywhere, and it's a pretty substantial tax increase for some locals. But again, the vote Tuesday, 11 to 7, polls are open. A lot coming down to this vote.
Right. You also reported on the opening of a new bike path in Sandwich, and it's been seen as a linchpin or a key piece to this Woods Hole to Provincetown continuous path, right, that's been talked about for decades. So tell us a little about this piece called the Sandwich Service Road Trail.
Yeah, this is 4 miles from one side of town to the other. I guess it's kind of off-road trail, meaning away from traffic. I spoke with the chair of the local bikeways committee, Sean Palloy, and he said they've really been working on this for a decade. And today, I believe at 11 this morning, there's an event to officially open the stretch. It has been open for several months now, though they've done some kind of minor improvements since then. But it's, you know, open during the winter, so they wanted to celebrate this in the right season today. But really, two things here. The goal is to make Sandwich more rideable. There's already some good bike paths that make the, you know, north to south route more accessible in town. But this opens it up east to west or west to east. So it crosses town from Route 130 or close to 130, close and then over to Barnstable. But the real big thing here is that this was kind of a missing piece in this 88-mile continuous bike path from Woods Hole to Provincetown. You know, I don't want to get anyone's hopes up that this is going to happen tomorrow by any means, but there is kind of a lot of momentum building around this idea going forward, and this Sandwich path is a big piece of that. And the idea, this will connect to the rail trail that's extending from Yarmouth into Barnstable now. And then on the other side, the hope is to connect Route 130 to the Cape Cod Canal with a bike trail. So I'm excited.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Sam Houghton. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Coming up, a father and son detained by ICE while fishing are now back on the vineyard. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. A father and son who were detained by ICE when they were out fishing are now back on the vineyard. Sarah Shaw Dawson from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So this started with really a Coast Guard seeing this boat and thinking it was some kind of boat registration violation. Is that how this all began?
Yes. So the father and son were out fishing with their friend and off of the coast of Menemsha. The Coast Guard boarded the boat after noticing a lack of vessel registration, which is a number on the side of the hull of the boat. And they were suspicious that there were possible other violations. They checked the ID of the adults, and they found that the father, De Silva Lima, Rodrigo, did not have current citizenship on his ID.
Mm-hmm. So what happened? They arrested both the father and the son.
They did. They arrested both of them off the coast of Menemsha that morning.
And the son was released first, and then the father, and that became a judge's ruling on that?
Yes. So the son was released on Friday and came back to the island. He's now staying with family members. And the father was released the following Wednesday. So the father, it was much more of a process, but the son was released into the custody of family members, and the judge cited that the detainment shouldn't have happened at all of the son. But the father is still in detainment in Burlington, was still in detainment in Burlington, Massachusetts, up until Wednesday afternoon. Mm.
So what's next for this father and son?
Well, they're both back on the island. They have an order by the judge to stay on the island, and to pursue the legal side of this, which is either self-deportation back to Brazil or staying on the island and remaining at home.
Yeah. And there were some demonstrations over the weekend over this, right? And this comes a year after the ICE sweep last May that many people might remember. It created a whole lot of fear in the community. So tell us what you're seeing. Is it the same kind of reaction now? Talk a little about these demonstrations and what you're seeing as far as if it's the same as the reaction last year.
Yeah, so last year it was there were a few rallies, a few demonstrations. There were a few groups who were very upset about what was going on, but there wasn't much action on that front. It was mostly conversations in the community, some outrage among people. And this time around, it's much more organized. The community has really risen up and tried to do something about this and prevent it from happening again. And that's been clear in both the younger and the older generations. Nicholas is the student who was taken off the Coast Guard by immigration enforcement. His classmates rallied behind him and did a walk out of the school last Friday. And then almost 300 islanders rallied in Menemsha just a few days later, rallying behind the father and son and advocating for their release and advocating for the Fourth Amendment rights of all Brazilian immigrants on the island.
Yeah. Sarah Shaw Dawson from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Some Nantucket parents are scrambling after they get word of a school bus driver shortage. Josh Bowling from the Inquirer and Mirror has more on that. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
So this is a result of some unexpected departures, right?
The unexpected departure of at least one bus driver. The schools weren't planning for it. We did have a sort of a late-breaking update to this story. The driver in question has gotten back to us, and there is some dispute as to how the driver left. We'll be following that up this week. But suffice it to say, they are down one more bus driver, so they're operating with a really shorthanded transportation staff, leaving the district with only one driver qualified to drive large school buses on the island and the equivalent of about three full-time drivers covering all of the routes. Nantucket Public Schools have an enrollment of about 1,500 students, although many of them do not take the bus to school regularly. So it's fewer number of students than that actually take the bus to school. But this is really causing a crimp in the school day and some consternation for parents and students. As if there's any sort of silver lining here, as the school year winds down, there's only a couple of weeks left to school, but it's still causing a problem. In an email to parents last week, school officials said there's no busing available for students on the west end of the island in Matticat, and that 7th through 12th grade students along Old South Road and in one of the larger subdivisions on the island in the middle of the island will need to find alternate transportation probably for the rest of the year. Mm. The schools are doubling up their bus runs in the mornings and afternoons to accommodate the shortage, but in the morning run in particular, the second run doesn't start until 7:40, meaning that students on that route are going to be late to school. And in the afternoon run, the second run doesn't begin until 3:20, which is almost an hour after school gets out, meaning students are going to have to stay at school until the bus returns from that first run. So it's causing some problems. On a positive side, I guess, school officials say there has been an overwhelming response from people interested in becoming bus drivers for next year. They're going to have a driver recruitment night at Nantucket High School on Monday. But this has been an issue for the Nantucket schools for quite some time. So it's a little curious to me that there's all this overwhelming interest now when they've really struggled to find bus drivers in the past. It's not not the most desirable job, I guess.
Right.
what you've got the kids to deal with, and it kind of split your day. It's it's an interesting job. It kind of requires a special schedule to do. But this is about the worst it's been in a number of years. 2021, 2022, there was also a shortage of bus drivers, and they were down to 3 large bus drivers. Now we only have 1, so something the school officials are going to really have to work on.
All right, and then this weekend, today, Nantucket Wine Festival, is that underway?
It did actually start yesterday. Officially. It's underway, goes through Sunday. It annually draws about 4,000 visitors to the island, and lots of islanders as well, each spring, for 5 days of wine tastings, receptions, wine dinners, at restaurants and private homes and function halls all over the island. And we've got some of the best winemakers, wineries, chefs and restaurants in the country and even in the world coming to the island for the festival. It's headquartered this year at Bartlett's Ocean View Farm, where the grand tastings are going to be held in big tents out in the farm fields. And they attract sometimes over 1,000 people, where they get to taste wines from, over 100 different winemakers from both Europe and America and all over the world. And then there are sort of more intimate dinners around town, some in private homes, some at restaurants, which generally consider this week the unofficial start of the summer, and they will remain open, at least on the weekends, until the busy season really begins around the 4th of July.
Yeah, it's going to feel like the busy season this weekend, though, isn't it?
I think it is.
All right, Josh Bolling from the Enquirer and Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Jet skis are banned on many ponds on the Cape, but their use on 2 ponds in Mashpee is being discussed next week. Callie Remillard from the Enterprise Newspapers joins us. Hi, Callie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So this is Johns and Mashpee Wakeby Ponds, right, which does allow jet skis.
Yes. So they are 2 of the only freshwater ponds on the Cape where folks can just show up, launch their jet skis. All of the other towns have either instituted like outright bans, or you need to have a resident permit to be able to launch there.
And so what's the topic of they want to regulate it more, or what's the talk next week?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of frustration from folks who live by the pond. These personal watercrafts can be super disruptive. They are saying that there has been a lot of trash left over on the beaches. The committee the other night was talking about how some trees have been cut down, too. We haven't been able to confirm that, but that's what the water quality coordinator was saying. And really, the crux of the issue here is that the state owns the land that Johns Pond and Mashpee Wakeby Pond boat ramps are on. So that really complicates things, because the town cannot, just institute these bylaws to ban them. Right. The other towns where those bans have been put in, those towns do own the land their boat ramp is on, so they can do that. But with the introduction of, the state ownership, things get a little muddy. So what the committee is looking to do in the short term is increase their enforcement of these watercraft usage on the ponds. The problem is that, you've got your harbor master, and he's out there patrolling the water, and you've got your police, both in Sandwich and in Mashpee, because the ponds, you can touch both sides. And the issue becomes, I was talking to the committee chairwoman, and she was telling me, you've got people on their jet skis, they see the harbor master coming, they hop off their jet skis. Now they're on the land. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have jurisdiction there. Mm. And then the police come, they hop back on the jet ski. It's like a little game of whack-a-mole. And there's talk of getting an environmental police boat down here to kind of help with that enforcement, because they can be on both the water and the land. So there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of discussions to be had. But this is hopefully going to start moving in the direction of enforcement as we head into the summer.
Yeah. And then the Mashpee Police Patrol Union announced members had unanimously voted no confidence in Police Chief Scott Caroline. What prompted that vote, and what does the police chief have to say?
So, yeah, that news broke earlier this week. What prompted that vote, we've been told by the police union, is that there have been repeated attempts to address certain issues. The initial statement that came out from the union wasn't entirely specific, pointing to specific issues, but there was a reference to a promotional process that unfolded over, I believe it was 9 months, that the union is saying there was really no solution that was reached, and that there is still no candidate list for this promotional process. Mm. And that was definitely one of the things that kind of kickstarted this vote of no confidence. And their statement was talking a lot about how there's a lack of transparency, a lack of accountability, and that the union's attempts to, bring this up and get this addressed have been ineffective. So that is where this statement came in. And we also spoke to Chief Carline, and he has said that until recently, no formal grievance has been filed regarding his leadership. So it's a little bit, it's sort of like a he said situation. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get to the bottom of, you know, what these allegations are. The town manager has also spoken out and said that he stands behind the police chief. It's definitely garnered a little side eye from because the statement was released on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I think some people are questioning why this is being portrayed on social media.
Right.
So we're not really sure how this is going to play out. There's a lot of conversations and, you know, looking into formal inquiries that need to play out. So we're going to keep a close eye on this and see what happens.
All right. More to come. Callie Rumelard from the Enterprise Newspapers. Thanks, Callie.
Thank you.
Some residents in Orleans are asking for easing up on the water restrictions. Ryan Bray from the Cape Cod Chronicle has more on that. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Mindy.
So residents are looking to have even just one day a week to water their lawns and gardens, right?
Yeah, that's really what's sort of before the Board of Water Sewer Commissioners now. But to sort of back up and set the table, back in March, the town really started off in almost a historically bad position in terms of its water levels in January, which prompted the board in March to adopt basically a full-on outdoor watering ban of, you know, sprinkler systems, no sprinkler systems, limiting to just, handheld watering and drip irrigation with some exceptions. That's in light of, obviously, the drought situation, and that's really trickles down from recommendations from the State Drought Advisory Board. Earlier this month, those restrictions for the drought level classification for the Cape was reduced from a level 2 to a level 1. Other towns have sort of opened up the option for, you know, one day a week outdoor watering. And now in Orleans, you know, they want the same thing. And that's part of the problem is there's no consistency from one town to the next in terms of what you can do. But Orleans right now is still holding pat on a pretty consistent ban because they're worried about, you know, with the summer season coming, just damaging or hurting their water supply further.
Yeah, and it's really tough when water restrictions vary town by town. You know, you go, well, my neighbor across the town line can water and I can't. It gets a little frustrating, I'm sure. So we'll hear more on this, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe the state's Drought Advisory Board is meeting again on June 8th, and the Board of Water Sewer Commissioners is ready to, you know, take whatever comes out of that meeting in terms of, you know, recommendations at the state level and act accordingly.
All right. Ryan Bray from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, Mindy.
Some Truro residents would like more bus shelters to protect from rain and sun. Lauren Hikamibi from the Provincetown Independent joins us. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So there's only one of eight stops currently that has a bus shelter, right? So tell us what's at issue here.
Yeah, that's right. So only one stop in Truro has a bus shelter. And as you can imagine, if you've ever taken the bus, it's not super fun to wait if it's raining. And sometimes the bus comes late. So ideally, Truro wants every bus shelter in town, every bus stop in town to have a bus shelter. For now, they're going to start by just adding one, and they're hoping it will be equipped with one of those electric signs that tells you how many more minutes you have to wait until the next bus arrives so that it's just more pleasant to wait for the bus.
Yeah, but nothing's going to happen really before the end of summer, right? Or are they going to have this one up before then?
Yeah, they're going to wait until at least the end of the summer once the tourist season is over. So we could be waiting a while for this.
All right. Lauren Hakamimi from the Provincetown Independent. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up, Cape Cod's tourism forecast. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Next, we check in on Beacon Hill, and CAI's Gil DeGeist gets the details from our State House reporter, Katie Lannon.
The state Senate passed a resolution recently that seems to indicate a shift in the standoff between state auditor Diana DeZoglio and state lawmakers over DeZoglio's attempt to audit them. Can you tell us more about the resolution?
Yeah, this is an advancement, but it's not a full end, it doesn't seem, to the standoff between DeZoglio and lawmakers. What the Senate agreed to is that it will provide, and soon, they say, a set of financial records to DeZoglio that have been kind of agreed upon as at least some of what she's seeking for this audit. The Senate has had constitutional concerns about complying with this audit, but they say these documents are public, so they're happy to provide them now that a court order has identified them as what's being sought here. Now, DiSoglio says they're still not fully complying with the audit because they're not cooperating with her because they're not agreeing yet that the audit is constitutional. In the Massachusetts House, which DiSoglio is also trying to audit, isn't taking a step like this. Instead, they say they want to pass more comprehensive transparency legislation to try and address constituents' concerns, but they haven't signaled plans to provide records to DiSoglio. So this is a step forward, but we still seem to be at somewhat of an impasse here.
This town meeting season, the Cape and Islands saw a lot of towns passing Proposition 2.5 overrides to fund their operating budgets. So a bill proposed by Governor Maura Healey last year was supposed to make it easier for towns and cities to raise taxes. How would this work?
So the governor filed a bill that would let cities and towns opt into adding an extra surcharge on car excise bills and raising their local level meals and lodging taxes, if they have them, to a higher level. The governor says those changes could generate tens of millions of dollars in extra revenue for communities without having to raise property taxes at a time of a housing crisis. And, you know, when the governor proposed this, she specifically said that the lodging tax, raising the ceiling on that, could be really meaningful on the Cape and in other places that have busy tourism economies.
So where does that bill stand now?
The bill has been kind of carved up by the legislature, and all three of those tax raising pieces are dead. They've been killed by a committee. The rest of the bill, which includes some other efficiency mechanisms that cities and towns have sought, are still alive. And cities and towns say they're still advocating not just for those pieces, but for really any revenue or enhanced state aid opportunities that might be available to them as they try to grapple with their ongoing budget squeezes.
The Massachusetts Democratic Party's nominating convention kicks off very soon. What are the biggest decisions Mass Dems will be making at the convention?
There's only really one meaningful decision that Democrats are going to make when it comes to endorsing candidates, and that's who their nominee for the U.S. Senate will be. Senator Ed Markey faces a challenge from North Shore Congressman Seth Moulton, but most of the rest of the races that'll be up for consideration by delegates are uncontested. The governor, the lieutenant governor, the treasurer, the attorney general, and the state auditor are running without Democratic primary challengers. I asked Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll recently what she thinks it means that so many of those races are going uncontested in the primary, and she says it's a sign that voters are happy with the direction the state is going in. Of course, there are still Republican candidates for some of those races, so it won't be a fully quiet election year.
All right. That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's officially summer for the tourism industry on the Cape following Memorial Day weekend. There's a lot of questions for the local economy with higher gas prices, new immigration policy from the federal government, and frustrated neighbors to the north. In an effort to get a sense of where we are headed this summer, CAI Sam Houghton spoke with Paul Nizwicki, the CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce.
Thanks so much for joining us, Paul.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Sam.
Now, with rising gas prices, and I would argue maybe economic uncertainty really seen across the country, what type of summer are you anticipating? Are businesses kind of nervous out there? How could this compare to other summers?
Well, I think we're expecting another solid summer on the Cape, but we do think it will be a value-conscious summer. You know, people still want the Cape, still very high demand, but they're watching prices, they're booking a little bit later. Stays seem to be shortening a little bit, but it's not going to affect them coming to the Cape. It may affect what they do once they get here. In the past, when we've seen higher gas prices, we really haven't seen a drop off because, you know, higher gas prices also mean higher fuel prices. And so international travel then becomes more expensive as well. So then the Cape captures, you know, those people that are looking for a drive to destination that will be less expensive than a fly to destination. Yeah. So we tend to benefit from that.
Yeah,
so I think it's going to be pretty solid.
And I guess one way to forecast kind of a summer is looking at hotel reservations. Have you heard from hotel managers, and what are you hearing in that sector?
Yeah, I mean, the bookings look pretty strong for the summer, especially if you look at some of the weed eater vacation numbers on short-term rentals, especially in the spring. They're up almost 20%. That's big. And some of the Expedia forecasts for July and August are up almost 10%, which is really, really big. So the booking interest is still there. I think what we are starting to see is somewhat of a stratification, economic stratification. You know, the 4 and 5 star resorts are doing really well. People with disposable income are still coming to the Cape and they're still spending money. But we're seeing a little bit more price sensitivity in the mid-level accommodations range. And it's not the same in every town or every sort of sub-region of the Cape. But we expect that people will be here and we're going to have another strong summer.
Yeah, okay. Now, one thing, you know, I think part of the Cape's tourism economy, and I think we do see it in the shoulder season, but Canada and maybe other foreign countries too, but we've actually heard that there has actually been a slowdown. How much of the Cape's summer economy is based on this travel from Canada, and is that a worrying trend for you?
I mean, that's always a worrying trend as it relates to, you know, international travel, which can make up about 15 to 17% of the visitor spend on the Cape in the summer. The Canadians are number one. But we are not as reliant on them as, say, the Maine coast and other places that are impacted more. And Canadians like to do things a little differently. They like the outdoors, the hiking, and the camping. So where we have seen some impact last year and likely will again this year are in some of the campgrounds on the Cape, where we have a lot of Canadian visitors. Provincetown also sees a real high number of Canadian visitors. So we expected more of a drop-off there last year, but we didn't really see it.
Huh.
To the extent that we are seeing fewer Canadian travelers there, it's one of the things that makes the Cape economy so resilient is the fact that we're a second homeowner community and not a resort community. I mean, 37% of the properties on the Cape are second homes. So that makes it very resilient. And it's also a finite place. To the extent that we are losing some international travelers, we've been able to backfill that with people that are from our larger catchment region of, you know, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, and Greater New England and New Jersey.
Now, you know, I think a big question out there every summer is, are we going to get enough workers? And I'd be really curious, like these impacts that we're seeing from the federal government, there's been reports that it's maybe harder to apply as a J-1 or H-2B. What are you hearing from businesses? Are they able to get the workers they need, or are they struggling there?
Yeah, most of our members and the businesses that we talk to that use J-1s and H-2Bs feel like they're going to be okay, but there has recently been some J-1s that had to cancel, didn't make their date. And that has to do for a lot of the sort of federal cutbacks in the State Department have impacted embassy staffing. There are increased vetting requirements now, especially as it relates to people's social media, which takes a lot more time. So where an embassy could have processed, you know, 100 applications in the past, they can only do 20, 25. But we've been working with the J-1 sponsoring agencies. And so we're still going to have what we need. I mean, we use 5,000 J-1s every summer, and there are only 100,000 of those summer work travel visas available through that program nationally, which will show you how dependent the Cape really is on that program. I think we are starting to see, at least anecdotally, some J-1s that businesses had planned on showing up, not showing up. But overall, I think we'll still have a pretty full complement of J-1 students over the summer supporting our seasonal economy.
That's Paul Nedzwicki, CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The restoration of a piece of local history was celebrated in a concert at a former church in Yarmouthport. CAI's John Basile has the story.
Take a drive or a walk along Route 6A in Yarmouthport, and you'll come across one of the architectural gems of Cape Cod. It's the former Swedenborgian Church of the New Jerusalem that in recent years has become a concert venue known as Thatcher Hall. Inside that elaborate yet somehow rustic building is a piece of Cape Cod history, a tracker organ built especially for that building in 1872. Like the building itself, the Oregon is from another time. The technology used in its design and construction is still impressive, but like all things old, needs to be updated every so often. To that end, a crew from the Andover Organ Company has been working to get the organ back in shape. Walter Chapin, who was a member of the congregation and led the effort to have the building transferred to a nonprofit organization, says the organ was a vital part of the church.
And to me, it's the heart of this building is that organ. And it was designed and built for this space. Clark did a good job. As I said, they installed it in the 1870s. They had no electricity. They had no power drills or saws. And they had no light. I don't know how they could get in there and put things together without lights, really. But they did it, and it stayed there for 150 years, so they must have done it right. It has been revoiced a couple of times. That's what they call changing the tones on the organ. And the reason that it had to be taken out and rebuilt, they finally put heat and air conditioning in the building within the last 10 years. And because they keep heat on in the winter, not much, but enough to keep the stenciling and everything from peeling, the heat affected the organ, and it dried all the leather and sliders because of that. So, and they've installed new sliders with wood that will not be affected by the temperature. So hopefully this has solved one of the problems.
The leader of the restoration project is Jonathan Ross. He says taking the organ apart, which involves thousands of pieces, and reworking its insides was only part of the job.
Unfortunately here, what we found was the floor had altered on us when we took it out. And then as we put it back in, sunk on us again is what we think happened. Basically, this organ had no shimming and no anything on the floor frame originally, and so we were trying to put it back in that way. It was always a little bit off-level, but not massively. But we ended up, after we put in some of the components and the floor sort of shrunk again after the you know, sort of settled back down, we ended up, just to make things work, we had to increase one corner of the organ and then, you know, level out according to that and the rest of it by about 1.25 inches. And so that was quite a lot to do in place after a lot of it had gone together. But if we hadn't put it together, we wouldn't have known we had to do that is the problem, because it sank on the floor. These old buildings, you can see here, the walls are going one way, the posts are going the same way, the floor is going the other way. And the organ just kind of had smushed its way with it, and so it wasn't too bad. But once you try to work on them, well, then everything gets different.
And Ross says despite upgrades over the generations, the organ is pretty much the same as when it was first built.
Basically, we've been working on this for about 1.5 to 2 years or so back in our shop. But the organ also underwent significant rebuild and changes back in 1960. Our firm did that as well. And so tonally, most of it was changed in 1960. What we're doing is making it sound a little more like it would have sounded originally, but not entirely. Mechanically, it's basically the same. We've replaced parts, but with like for like in terms of functionality. Just some of the old parts, in this case, the old squares here were not particularly good, and so we replaced all of those, for instance, which are couplers that transfer motion from vertical to horizontal, for instance. And all those we replaced. We replaced all the original trackers because they were breaking. Old, 150-year-old wood gets kind of brittle after a while. And so things like that. But a lot of it is still the same and functioning as it always did. Part of our thing was to undo some of what was done in the 60s, as is often the case, and try to get it back a little more to what it should be.
When I visited, with the date of a concert approaching, it was time to hear music from the old instrument once again. Organ voicer Martin Neer stepped to the keyboard. So after 150 years of use and after thousands of hours devoted to restoration, Tracker organ at Thatcher Hall is in full voice once again. And for CAI, I'm John Basile.
And that wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.